Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer in Tel Aviv. Where is Israel heading since October 7th, and will the country and the region ever be the same? That was the focus of a conference recently held by Haaretz together with the UCLA Nazarian Center for Israel Studies. It included a wide range of speakers and panels. In this special edition of our podcast, we're featuring two of those sessions. First, Haaretz editor-in-chief Aluf Ben interviews Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times foreign affairs correspondent Thomas Friedman. They discuss the ongoing Israel-Gaza war and its effect on global diplomacy and security. After that, a conversation with General Noam Tibon and his son Amir, Haaretz's diplomatic correspondent. The dramatic story of Noam's rescue of Amir and his family on Kibbutz Nachal Oz on October 7th, saving the family from the Hamas terrorists who infiltrated the kibbutz, made international headlines in the weeks after it took place. In this interview with Haaretz English deputy editor Maya Lecker, father and son are looking back at those dramatic events. They talk about what their lives have been like since and the war that has unfolded. They also deliver a strong political message about the kind of leadership that Israel needs, in their opinion, to make sure that the failures of October 7th are never repeated. All that coming up. We'll begin with the session at the Haaretz UCLA conference featuring Aluf Ben and Thomas Friedman, titled The Impact of October 7th on Israel's Foreign Relations.
Hi, Tom. Welcome to Haaretz UCLA conference. Is that the toughest period that you can recall in Israel from your experience?
Yeah, I would say so from many levels. One is the sheer number of casualties caused by the Hamas attack, the sheer number of casualties caused by the Israeli retaliation, and the fact that it's all happening in a global environment. You know, when the Ukraine war broke out, I said, this is actually World War One. Oh, that thing we called World War One, 1914 to 1918, wasn't really a world war. Half the world was colonized then. Half the world were subsistence farmers. Ukraine war is the first true world war. Everyone could follow it on a smartphone. People could opine about it. Agricultural impact were felt almost immediately because Ukraine and Russia were such big fertilizer exporters. So it was felt on food prices. It was a real world war. I argue that Israel-Gaza is actually World War II. This is the
second. In what sense?
In the sense that everyone in the world has an opinion about it, is following it, is affected by it, and it touches classrooms everywhere, at every university. And every war now is almost becoming
a war. When we talk about Israel's global stance, first of all, the relationship with the United States. On one hand, we see unprecedented support, especially military support, diplomatic support, veto at the United Nations, arms shipments flowing into Israel. And at the same time, growing concern and growing criticism from the Biden administration, and much more so from the progressive parts of the Democratic Party. Are we going to diverge? Or is that both the best and the worst time in Israel-U.S. alliance?
I mean, you could say that even more broadly for Israel, this is a moment of incredible opportunity and great peril. Because on the one hand, before the war started, you had Saudi Arabia reaching out, offering to normalize with Israel on condition Israel make progress with the Palestinians. And at the same time now, we've seen a collapse in support for Israel among a certain demographic and among a certain particular part of the Democratic Party spectrum. And so, look, this is very dangerous. I mean, if I look at the future right now, Aluf, I would say this to you, that Israel's either going to come out of this war with a new relationship with Palestinians in 2024, or we're going back to 1947-48 with new weapons. So it's either going to be a new relationship in 2024 or back to the founding, war with new weapons, precision weapons. But 2023 is no longer available.
But what could Israel do to affect that? Just, you know, by accepting the Biden idea, the Biden doctrine, the Biden plan for two-state solution, and adding the normalization with Saudi Arabia and maybe other Arab countries, just by saying so, when the ruling government in Israel and the Prime Minister Netanyahu opposed that idea strongly. They say that this would be the end of Israel and defeat if the Palestinian state comes out of that war.
Look, I'll be honest. I mean, I think this is the worst government Israel's ever had. I think Bibi Netanyahu will go down as the worst leader in Jewish history, not just in Israeli history. I follow Israeli politics very closely my whole adult life. I know virtually nobody in this Israeli cabinet. I would not let this Israeli cabinet be waiters at my grandson's bar mitzvah. I think this is a group, save for a few people like Gallant and others, are truly incompetent. And what makes it so incompetent is that they launched a war to eliminate Hamas after October 7th for very legitimate security reasons, but without any plan for the morning after. And those of us who lived through 9/11 know what happens when you do that. And it wouldn't take much, but if Israel did have a plan to partner with the Palestinian Authority to work toward the long-term goal of two nation states for two people, it would solve three problems. Right now, Israel's losing on the narrative front. It has no narrative about how the war should end. It's losing on the Gaza front. It has no plan for security in Gaza once Hamas is smashed, and we've seen that now in the food rioting. And it has no ability to generate the regional allies it needs to deal with the Iranian octopus that is squeezing Israel through its proxies of Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis, and Islamic militias in Iraq. If Israel had a plan to work with the Palestinian Authority or transform Palestinian Authority toward two states for two nations, it would change the narrative. It would change the Gaza options, and it would vastly create cement a regional alliance so Israel's Arab allies and America's Arab allies could work together against Iran. Without that, Israel's just naked on all three fronts.
But what we see is the opposite. We see members of the cabinet and members of the coalition calling for the, you know, depopulation of Gaza from Palestinians, expelling them to the Sinai or to Europe or to elsewhere, and just building Jewish villages and towns in all those places that were demolished during the war in Gaza.
That's madness. It's not something that, let's forget Europe, you know, the Middle East, the Muslim world, and how it would react. That would produce a ferocious counter-reaction from the U.S. Congress, and I would say from Democrats and Republicans. It's a fantastic, absurd, and insane notion, but it reflects something. And because when I see it and I think about it, that, you know, you do have a generation, and you have a segment of Israel that I think has been living in a bubble, an ideological bubble, a religious nationalist bubble, and it's now in charge. And so the instincts that you and I might have, or just a sort of a moderate friend of Israel, I don't think they're in this group. I think they're all talking to themselves. And the fact that they are now in such an important leadership position makes me really worried for Israel's future.
Did you ever, even in your worst dream, thought that Israel would stand accused at the International Court of Justice of genocide?
You know, I find that horrific. I think it's wrong. I don't think this is genocide. I do think it's a terrible war in which too many civilians were killed, but I don't believe it was deliberate. But it's a reflection of both where the left is globally right now, but also a reflection of the way Israel has launched a war without any political vision, and therefore leaving itself exposed to people who are truly hostile, ill-intentioned. But Israel's just served itself up on a golden platter.
Could the war affect the American presidential election?
Yicholiot. I mean, I doubt it, but it could. Obviously, it would come down to a state like Michigan, and if Muslim and Arab American voters in Michigan carry through with their threat to stay home or vote for Trump or either one, it could in a close election make a difference. I hope they don't do that. I hope they reflect on who Donald Trump is and what that would mean for Arab and Muslim Americans if he becomes president again. But there's definitely, you know, in the left wing of the Democratic Party, just a great deal of questioning and hostility, even to Israel right now. And Israel has just made it too easy for people there not to, this Israeli government, not to take seriously the threat of Hamas and Israel's predicament. But it's when you launch a war with no vision for the morning after, let alone a very simple vision of let's work toward two states for two nations, for two indigenous people, you leave yourself open to this. And I worry terribly. A friend of mine was joking to me the other day, if there were another Israel, I'd go live there. But there isn't. So this is the Jewish state that the Jewish people have. And it needs more responsible leadership, not a leader who is focused, it seems to me, entirely on his own political survival.
But there is a streak in the Israeli right wing that believes that if Donald Trump returns to the White House, then Israel would be off the hook and we just get a carte blanche to do whatever it wants vis-a-vis the Palestinians and elsewhere. And all that government has to do is to wait out until the American election and then get a free hand.
Anyone who is betting on Donald Trump to do anything you expect him to do is a damn fool.
Do you fear that Israeli democracy would be or could be just another victim of that war? Following the judicial coup that Netanyahu was trying to promote before the war, and that some of his underlings are still promoting under the shadow and fog of the war, could Israeli democracy be a casualty here?
Well, you know, let me start from 30,000 feet. I really just write about three things these days: Trump, Ukraine, and Israel. Because I believe if Netanyahu survives this war, if Ukraine loses to Putin, and if Trump is reelected, the world I want to leave for my new grandchildren is just not going to be here. And so these are very, very important stories, as far as I'm concerned. As you know, because we've talked, I was singularly focused on fighting against the judicial coup that Netanyahu was mounting in the months before this war. But as you also may recall, the morning after the election that brought Bibi Netanyahu to power back in November of 2022, I wrote a column, the lead of which was "The Israel You Knew Is Over." And that was because I actually knew these people. I covered Kahana when I was the New York Times correspondent back in the 80s in Israel. And I tried to explain to my American Jewish friends, you didn't go to Camp Ramah with these people. They were not in the cabin in the Catskills next to you. You've never met these people. They just walked right out of the Second Temple. And if you don't take them seriously and understand that Israel, its fate, future, and character as a democracy and as a moderate Jewish state that can appeal to a broad spectrum of American and world Jewry, if you don't think that's up for grabs, you're not paying attention at all. And so I made that a huge focus of my column writing, and I'm proud to say that I helped get President Biden to make two statements in opposition to the judicial reform. Judicial coup that Netanyahu was promoting, which he did in my column, and I that fight is not over. These people are Israel is to wider trends in politics what off Broadway is to Broadway, and just as you have a trend within the Republican Party today that really believes that authoritarian government is the best thing for America right now, you have the exact same trend in Israel in miniature. And that's who these people are. And the only thing that can save Israel, the only thing that can save America, is if people turn out and vote these people out with the singular focus that isn't about taxes, it isn't about education policy, it isn't even about as important issue as abortion. There's a deeper, broader issue. This is about the fate and future of democracy in Israel and in the United States. That's where we're at.
And how do you see the implications of the war on the Jews in the diaspora and in the United States in particular? I just read Franklin Foer's piece in The Atlantic about the end of the golden age of for Jews in America. Do you feel that?
I'm very concerned. I think Frank made a very compelling point that we live in an age where both the far right and the far left are hostile to Israel. But I don't think it's irreparable. If there were a different Israeli government, a national unity government of the center left and center right, I think all of that is reversible with just one move, agreeing to engage in dialogue with Palestinians over a process to develop two nation states for two people. I think it's fixable, but I think if we don't go there, there will just be a steady erosion of the next generation coming up. I mean, I'm of a generation. I've had a huge amount of experience with Israel over many years. I've known a very different Israel before Benjamin Netanyahu. But there are a lot of 20-year-olds in America right now who the only Israel they know is the Israel of Bibi Netanyahu, an Israel of settlements, of impugning any hope for a Palestinian state. And that's not to any way excuse Palestinians for the huge missed opportunities that they've let go, for the very poor leadership and terrible decisions they've made. But it is a fact that there's a whole cottage industry now, Lou, for people writing a two-state solution's a fantasy. It's a fantasy. Never going to happen. What are you talking about? To which I say, oh, thank you for explaining that to me. I thought it was easy. Here I was. I was just thought it was easy. Oh, thank you. I don't know how many trees have been cut down for these articles about a two-state solution is impossible. To which I have a very simple question in Hebrew. Asma. Okay. So, I happen to think it's super difficult, but I happen to think the alternatives are all much, much worse. And that I have actually a lot of confidence in the Israeli people after this is over, that they will take in what has happened. And with the right leadership on the Israeli side and the Palestinian side and American side, I think a different discussion is possible.
Thanks, Tom, for a very candid appreciation of the situation in Israel, in the region, and the world. And on that half-optimistic note, about the opportunity that still might come out of this mess. I'd like to thank you.
Thank you. Great for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
That was Aluf Ben and Thomas Friedman. And now we turn to another session at the conference. Maya Lecker talking to Amir Tibon and Noam Tibon in a session looking at October 7th's impact on Israeli society and politics.
Amir and Noam have probably told their October 7th story hundreds of times since that Saturday morning when Amir, his wife, and two young daughters locked themselves in their safe room in their home in Kibbutz Nachal Oz as Hamas terrorists went from house to house in the kibbutz. While the Tibbons' story is unique, Amir had the fortune of being rescued by his father and the brave soldiers who joined him on his mission. They were both among the first to say, although there were many heroes on October 7th, Israel as a country failed us. So I want to start with you, Noam. Did you realize that right away when you got the call from Amir, made your way south? Did you feel how bad the country has failed us, or did it settle in?
I got the first text from Amir when I finished my swimming in the Mediterranean Sea here in Tel Aviv. and basically said, you know, that there are terrorists in the neighborhood in Nahal Oz. And then basically I tried to call, you know, the chief of staff, the southern commander, and others whom I know from my military background. And 10 minutes later, when I was home changing, I got a gut feeling that I need to go there. Usually, as a military general, I always trusted the IDF to solve any problem. And on that day, I got a gut feeling, basically said, you have to go there. I cannot explain it. But I'm glad that I listened to my heart and went to the south, because basically on that day, Hamas occupied most of the Gaza envelope. And the military failed to protect our kibbutzim, moshavim, ufakim, Sderot. And this was the mission of my life.
Amir, did you realize that?
You know, Kibbutz Nachal Oz, the community that I'm a part of, is the closest community in Israel to Gaza. And for 70 years, it has sat directly on the border. And throughout the decades, there were always security challenges. The first mortar was launched at the kibbutz in the 1950s. And there were ambushes in the fields of the kibbutz and landmines. And later, there was the first intifada and the second intifada. The first Qassam rocket was fired at the kibbutz in 2001. But one thing never, ever happened before. In 70 years of history, a terrorist had never stepped foot inside Kibbutz Nachal Oz. And I think something that both my father, from his perspective, and our little family from our situation where we had terrorists firing into our house, we realized that if the terrorists are inside the kibbutz, something that has never happened before, it means the defense lines of Israel have been breached. This is something that is not supposed to happen.
You know, I watched you on 60 Minutes. That was about a month after.
Everything happened very fast.
Right. Seemed like a month, but probably was 10 days. And you were talking about the hostages and how that has to be our main mission.
Yes.
This was when still all hostages were still in Gaza. 5 months later, did you think we would still be talking about bringing back the hostages?
No. In my community, 7 people were kidnapped by Hamas, all of them civilians. 5 were released in the deal that President Biden orchestrated together with Qatar and Egypt, in November. Basically, all the women and the girls, because in our kibbutz, it's important to remember, Hamas kidnapped an 8-year-old and a 15-year-old, 2 sisters. So all of the women and the girls have been returned alive to our community. And we still have 2 fathers, husbands, friends, neighbors, Omri and Tzachi, both in their 40s, civilians, who are still held in the hands of Hamas in Gaza. And I think it is unacceptable. And yet we live with it every day. This is something that has to be solved. And I do want to applaud President Biden for making it the number one priority right now, to bring back these hostages alive. This is the number one test for Israel and, frankly, for humanity. We need these people back with us, alive with their families.
Did you notice from the beginning that it has become the priority of the U.S. government, but maybe not so much the Israeli government?
We had an interesting test case of that in our community, because 2 of the hostages in Nachal Oz were U.S. citizens, and their relatives in the community told us all the time, President Biden has spoken with us personally on the phone more than once, and we haven't heard a word from Netanyahu or anyone in his government.
Yeah. Did you think you would still be away from your homes 5 months?
Yeah, and this is not a surprise. We hope to come back home. We are working on it. We are raising money for the repair of the kibbutz and the reconstruction of it, but it will take time. It's a very difficult mission and it will take time. We need to be patient about that part.
Yeah. Do you still live in as a community in some way?
We basically, all of our community had been evacuated to a kibbutz near Haifa, Kibbutz Mishmar Emek. They've been hosting us since October 8 with amazing generosity, and we are still mostly together. A few here and there people went to other places, but most of the community is there. And we're waiting to see what comes out of the war and when it will be possible to go back.
Yeah. Noam, maybe as a former commander of the Northern Formation, you can say, did you expect that we would have pretty much the same situation for the people living on the northern border and what we can expect there?
Yes, because one of the terrible things that happened to the state of Israel on October 7, that our neighbors, the Arab, basically saw the failure of the government, the failure of the military, and they are not afraid from us. Our deterrence broke to pieces. And that's why Hezbollah feel comfortable to basically, in very limited resources, to evacuate all the northern people in the state of Israel. And the government has no solution to it. I believe that the American initiative that President Biden put on the table, which include solution for Gaza, bring back the hostages, solution for the north, and more important than this, strategic relationship between the U.S., Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf countries. This is very important. And I think this can be a very good start to solve the issue of the North. But if it will not work, then Israel need to practice, be ready, and then to attack southern Lebanon. I served there many years in order that our citizens can live peacefully with security at home in the south and, yes, in the north as well.
This is a question for both of you. I was thinking in the last few weeks we've seen how the protests we have usually on Saturday nights, the protests to bring back the hostages and the more political protests to bring down the government. And in the last few weeks, they have in some ways merged, while some people still want them to be separate. Do you feel like it is now more of the same fight?
I understand why the families of the hostages don't want the two protests to officially merge and become one, and I think it's important to respect it. But I do believe that without significant public pressure on the government, it will be more difficult to bring back the hostages. I also think there has to be very significant pressure, obviously, on Hamas. And I think it's important to put pressure on Qatar because it is the one country that has the most influence on Hamas. But I'm not naive about the fact that there are also political interests on our side, and that public pressure, whether it's through these demonstrations on Saturday night or other mechanisms, is very important right now because we do have an opportunity. The administration is pushing, and it has put on a reasonable formula for all sides for a hostage deal. And I think it will be a terrible mistake if we don't move forward with it.
On October 8 in the morning, I basically said that everyone that in charge of this failure, the biggest failure of the history of the state of Israel, this is the day that we lost more Jews than any other day since the Holocaust, need to go away. And I mean all the leadership of the IDF, which basically took responsibility, and I know that they will go. All the leadership of the Shabakh, the same, they took responsibility. And all the government of Israel, and the first one who need to take responsibility and go home is Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister. I believe that Benjamin Netanyahu is personally in charge of this failure. He was the one which basically developed that Hamas is an asset. He was the one that in charge that all the billions of dollars came from Qatar to the hand of the Hamas, which basically transferred itself from a terror organization to a strong military force. And it's still actual today. Benjamin Netanyahu should go away as soon as possible. Even President Biden said it, that today Netanyahu is hurting the state of Israel. I believe that Benjamin Netanyahu basically put those hostages as in a political card, which is unacceptable. It's human life. We will not win the war without bringing them home. We will not win the war. And once it's a political card between Benjamin Netanyahu and all the most extreme parts in the Israeli society, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, this is very, very dangerous, because a country which is not taking care of citizens is not a good country. And we are going to fight. We are going to fight on those two fronts. Number one, to bring the hostages home. Everyone that is still alive. That's why I said to bring them home alive. Alive. And number two, to have an open election in Israel as soon as possible, and to bring the right leadership to the state of Israel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maya, and to our friends at UCLA.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. The entire Haaretz UCLA conference is available for viewing on YouTube. A link's provided on the podcast page. Thanks to this episode's producer, Avi Rosenzvi, and editor, Nara Malkin, and to everyone who made the conference possible. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer. Thanks for listening to this special episode.